We're going to hear this morning is United States versus Wilson, and Mr. Dietz, whenever you're ready, we'll hear from you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Richard Dietz. I represent the appellant, Donald Jamal Wilson. Your Honors, the central issue in this appeal is whether a special deadline that was imposed by Congress on the government is jurisdictional, meaning it can't be waived by the parties, and it must be assessed by the court on its own initiative. And the deadline at issue in this case was enacted as part of the Civil Asset Forfeiture Reform Act, which I'll call CAFRA. And CAFRA was a law that was intended to restrict government abuses of the Civil Forfeiture Act. And as the court's aware, civil forfeiture lawsuits are something of a strange animal. A civil forfeiture case, as the court's aware, the United States government is the plaintiff, and it brings a suit against its citizens' own property, sort of under a legal fiction that the property is a wrongdoer, that it's the ill-gotten gains of some illicit activity. And the deadline that's at issue in this case, Congress enacted the statute and this deadline to restrict a particular type of government abuse that Congress was concerned was coming dangerously close to violating its citizens' Fifth Amendment rights under the Due Process Clause and the Takings Clause. And the reason is that, as Congress explained in the statute, before CAFRA was enacted, the government would often seize property under the civil forfeiture statutes, and then it would provide no indication of when it would initiate the civil forfeiture lawsuit. And so a citizen would have its property taken away by the government, receive no just compensation, and have no idea when, if ever, the government intended to pursue a civil forfeiture action. And so the purpose...
Mr. Dietz, excuse me. I take it your position would require, clearly, every district judge or magistrate judge who first looks at a complaint such as this to somehow explore whether or not jurisdiction exists.
That's correct, correct? Your Honor.
And would that require the government to include allegations that show jurisdiction, such as in a regular civil action?
I think it would be the court's obligation on its own initiative to determine whether there was jurisdiction. I think it would be a good practice for the government to do that. I'm not sure that there would be a requirement that they'd have to do it in the complaint, but of course the court would.
How could the district judge do her job?
Right, I think the court would have to ask the government to provide that information if it wasn't already included in the complaint.
Would the court have to do that before or after arresting the property? Because does the court have jurisdiction to arrest the property before deciding whether it has subject matter jurisdiction over the in rem action? How would that work?
Your Honor, I think yes. I think that the actual arrest is issued, if I understand the rules correctly, that arrest from the United States Marshal Service is done by the government. So I think that what would happen is
No, that's not an arrest. The government has possession. But to bring the property into the jurisdiction of the court has to arrest the property.
Right. I understand your yeah. point, Your Honor. Yes, I think that's right. The court could not obtain in rem jurisdiction. Our position is because it would not have subject matter jurisdiction over the action.
Where did it get the in rem jurisdiction?
In
this case.
In this case, the United States Marshal Service, pursuant to the rules in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, there's a supplement that provides rules in forfeiture actions, and the in rem jurisdiction came from the United States Marshal Service.
Where does the district court get its jurisdiction in this case?
It gets its subject matter jurisdiction from Section 1355, which is the...
And what about it also, the authorization under 21 U.S.C. Section 1881, which authorizes the forfeiture?
That's right. That's right, Your Honor. So there are steps.
If you have a court having power to consider this type of thing, and a statute that gives authorization to district courts to consider these things, isn't that pretty powerful evidence that that 983 is just a procedural section on how to proceed?
No, Your Honor, and I'll explain why. I think if you, for example, take this court's jurisdiction, Section 1291, which provides the jurisdiction of this court in appeals from the district courts. There's nothing in Section 1291 that discusses the time to file an appeal. And there's a separate statute.
Now, that is a special circumstance. And as you know, the Supreme Court has found that the appeal process in civil cases is jurisdictional because of a long-standing custom. It could have gone either way on that, but they decided to go that way. And in a criminal case, of course, you know it's not jurisdictional. But I think the going from one level to another is different from a circumstance where Congress creates Section 1355 and then creates Section 881, 21 U.S.C. Section 881, which authorizes district courts to handle forfeiture cases and gives them the power to do that. And now you have the government coming in and invoking the jurisdiction granted under 1355 and the authorization under Section 881, and it does so late. Now, you're arguing that because it did so late, that's jurisdictional too. But with these other provisions, it's a pretty dicey claim to make.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I will stay away from the appellate jurisdiction. Let me give a much better example, and that is the John R. Sand and Gravel case, the six-year statute of limitations to file a claim in the United States Court of Federal Claims. And there is, of course, in 28 United States Code, there's a provision, I don't know the specific number, but it's close to all the 1331 and 1332 that provides the jurisdiction of the Court of Federal Claims. There's also a separate, entirely separate statute that provides the six-year statute of limitations. And the Supreme Court and John R. Sand and Gravel said that statute of limitations provision, although it's not anywhere near the jurisdictional grant to the Court of Federal Claims, is a jurisdictional deadline. And the reason was the court in John R. Sand and Gravel said there are some time deadlines, so statute of limitations deadlines, that have system-wide goals. In other words, the goal is not to provide an individual litigant with an affirmative defense in a particular case.
Isn't that rooted as well in sovereign immunity?
Well, that was the system-wide goal, of course. And the Court of Federal Claims is that it's very rare for the government to waive its sovereign immunity, allow money damages claims to be brought by citizens against the government. But as the Ninth Circuit acknowledged in the Marley case cited in our brief, there are many. The Supreme Court in John R. Sand and Gravel indicated there were other reasons as well, and this case is one of those reasons.
At the time Congress passed Section 983A, is there any indication that Congress knew the difference between jurisdiction and claims processing statutes?
Your Honor, that's an excellent point, I think it's... The answer is no, I think...
Right. So we have to decide now, and maybe it's with good reason, because maybe the law hadn't really developed as distinctly as it has on that issue. But now we have to decide which of those two categories this would fall under. What do you make of the except that a court in the district in which the complaint will be filed may extend the period for filing a complaint for a good cause shown or upon agreement of the parties? Is it typical that the jurisdiction of the court depends on agreement of the parties?
Your Honor, I think this type of provision is typical, and I think that there's an important...
You don't have any case where the parties can confer jurisdiction on a federal court.
Well, that's why I wanted to take a little bit of issue with the way that Judge Shedd had characterized the question to me. I wanted to be clear
I'm reading it. I'm just reading it. I just read about the statute, and you get the point. The point is, I don't know what I did to... How did I characterize it?
Well, Your Honor, I think that there is jurisdiction until the 90-day time period has run.
No. I'm talking about no. What if the claim could be heard on the 95th day because the parties have agreed to it?
Or on the 89th day.
Right.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that can happen, and that's the part that I wanted to clarify. Your Honor, I think Congress was very clear.
You can't?
When the window has closed, Congress said, you can extend the deadline before it's expired. You can.
Of course you can, but under the statute, you have to do it before the deadline, but they are still conferring jurisdiction on a court to hear it 100 days out.
Yeah, how does that happen?
The parties are determining that now you can hear it 100 days out.
How do parties confer jurisdiction on the federal court?
Well, Your Honor, of course, there are many situations in which Congress creates a deadline, and for good cause shown, the court can extend.
Subject matter jurisdiction. I'm not aware of any statute where the parties can agree on it.
Well, Your Honor, and so of course, let me start by saying Congress defines.
Let me just finish my point. I think you're going to get there. And my point is, if in fact the parties can extend, if the parties can create jurisdiction in a circumstance that otherwise the courts would not have it, That's not jurisdiction, it seems to me. That's the claims process.
Yes, Your Honor. And I will concede if the parties can extend the deadline after it's expired, then Mr. Wilson will lose.
Not after it expired, before.
But if it's before it expired, I think it still can be a jurisdictional deadline, and here's why. If you look, for example, at Rule 4 of the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure, and there, of course, not only can...
You told us you were going to stay away from...
I did, Your Honor, but I think here this is right. But you can see that the district courts can actually retroactively extend the time to file an appeal. And that's, I think it's Rule 4A5. And then the court...
That might be a powerful argument that that case should have been decided differently. And I think the Supreme Court had sort of shaky hands when it did it. I think it did it very deliberately because the custom and practice for so long had been to treat the appellate process as, in a civil case, as jurisdictional. But I can tell you, it doesn't fit with their normal protocols of the fact that the power of the court is created by Congress, and not the power, not the lawyers. And Congress, I'm not aware of a situation where they said, with the agreement of the parties, the subject matter jurisdiction of the court can be conferred. That's a strange bird, isn't it?
Yes, and Your Honor, I acknowledge I can't give you an example of that either. But what I can say is that in this case, ultimately what we're looking at is what Congress intended. It's not this court's role or the Supreme Court's to set barriers of what Congress must stay in order to create jurisdiction.
No, wait a second, though. But what best decides what Congress intended other than their words?
And Your Honor, that's why I think the words here are very telling, because what Congress said in this statute is after the window has closed, and it can be extended, but by the parties or by the court for good cause, but once the window closes, the property will return and there will not be a forfeiture action.
No. No, but if it was filed, let's say, on the 89th day and went and said the parties agreed it has to be filed by the 180th day, then between 90 and 180 is creating something for the court to hear that Congress didn't give the authority for them to hear. Congress didn't say that in the statute. The parties picked that date. That's the problem that you're up against. It strikes me that probably you're right. And what Congress may well have been trying to do, they just didn't do it. It doesn't appear to me that they did it.
Well, I think the response to that, Your Honor, is that, as I was saying, ultimately this court has to look at what Congress wanted, because Congress decides what provisions are jurisdictional and which aren't. And if this court says that this is a waivable claims processing rule,
But we also have to look at that in light of what the Supreme Court has told us about jurisdiction and claims processing. We have to consider that too, don't we?
That's correct, Your Honor. But I think in that case, John R. Sand and Gravel is the key case for our position, because you can see Congress had a system-wide goal here.
Who drafted the title to this case, this statute, Section 983? That was Congress? I know we don't look to titles usually.
Yes, the title of the Civil Asset Forfeiture Reform Act?
It's Section 983 says general rules for civil forfeiture proceeding.
Right. And again, Your Honor,
I'm talking about jurisdiction now. It does talk in other sections about conferring jurisdiction on district courts. And it talks about the procedure generally in 18 U.S.C. Section 921.
That's correct, Your Honor. But again,
Says a procedure may be adopted. And then this section says general rules for civil forfeiture proceedings.
That's correct, Your Honor. But again, there are many other examples. You can look to Bowles versus Russell, to John R. Sand and Gravel, even, for example, the Certificate of Appealability rules in the Gonzalez case. And in none of the statutes, the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act is another example. None of those provisions, did Congress use the word jurisdiction either in the section enacting that provision or in that provision itself?
You have to think, was Congress talking about the power of the court to act, or was Congress talking about the procedure for exercising that power? And you go to the old Steel Company case, which is really not directly on point, but they talk about jurisdiction, what it means. And in that case, the Supreme Court pointed out that with respect to jurisdiction, we're talking about the power.
That's right, Your Honor.
To act at all.
And I think,
of course, any element of an offense that's omitted, Congress puts four elements, and somebody fails to prove the third element, you could argue, oh, the court doesn't have jurisdiction. Supreme Court says that's not the case. The court had the authority to consider the case. And in this case, in the absence of somebody raising it, or by agreement of the parties, the court has to consider it.
Yes, Your Honor, I acknowledge that. But I think the key is, if you would ask Congress, if Congress knew that this would be interpreted as a waivable claims processing rule, which really means it's a dead letter, we all understand that Most of these litigants are incarcerated. They're indigent, so they can't afford counsel. We have Miranda because most litigants don't even know about their constitutional right to counsel. So surely here, these litigants are not going to know about this obscure statute of limitations or jurisdictional deadline provision that's in this statute. And so if you had told Congress, and of course the government has a financial incentive to pursue these types of forfeitures
could
even
Congress,
after the deadline.
Congress have written this more explicitly and clearly?
They could have. They did not.
They should have.
But, Your Honor,
how about that?
My position is it's this court's job to interpret the statute as Congress intended and not to tell Congress do it different next time.
Yeah, and if they did it too clearly, we wouldn't have a job.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And that would be bad.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. All right, Mr. Pullen. Ms. Pullen, excuse me.
May it please the court. as counsel noted, this is a case involving the interpretation of the 90-day statute of limitation or statutory deadline and what effect that has when the government misses that deadline. In response to initially to counsel's reliance on the John Sand and Gravel case, that case the court found that there was a historical reliance or historical view of the statute at issue in that as jurisdictional, and that was the reason that that case that statute was found jurisdictional.
Why didn't you just file timely, and then? And then agree to ask the court to hold it while you worked out other details. Well, wouldn't that have solved it if you just the government just filed timely?
Well, yes, Your Honor. But at the time that the complaint was filed, we were not aware it had been filed untimely.
And that makes it worse.
Yeah.
I don't want to be unfair to you, but it's one of the most disturbing aspects of this case is that the government didn't pay attention.
Well,
with all respect, and that should disturb everybody, because government, especially government lawyers, are supposed to pay attention.
That's absolutely right, Your Honor. The government does take very seriously the deadline in the 90-day deadline in the.
So as Judge Shedd said, why not, if you know that the clock is ticking and you're emailing with the DEA, why not just file it, transfer a venue, do whatever you need to do, but pay heed to what Congress has instructed, because that's some pretty powerful language that Congress has forced it on you.
That's correct, Your Honor.
You're not entitled to the property anymore if you don't file it within 90 days. That's what Congress has said.
That's correct, Your Honor. What happened in this case was the cash was actually seized in the state of Ohio.
And that's going to happen a million times a year in the United States, mm-hmm. right?
That's correct.
West Virginia, Ohio, West Virginia, Maryland, Virginia.
Well,
that's not much of an explanation.
Well, at the time, I wasn't clear if I had jurisdiction to file the forfeiture complaint until coordinating with our criminal division whether
the file it and take your chances. If you're not sure, make a reasonable judgment on it and file with the court. You might be better off a court saying you don't have jurisdiction to do that than having to come up here and decide whether or not you have jurisdiction. Seems to me that might be a reasonable way to proceed.
I would absolutely do that in the future.
Would other people in your office do that, or is it one at a time that we would take up their cases? Would we expect to see another case like this from another assistant or something?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. Absolutely not.
Is part of the problem, is it your administrative staff that does all of the preparation for these things?
No, I actually...
I don't want you to talk out of school.
That's who we can throw under the bus.
Yeah. I am responsible.
Right.
I am responsible
and,
for...
And
my
I appreciate that. That's a great answer.
And I accept full responsibility in this case.
And we'll send a copy of this transcript to all the staff.
You don't doubt, do you, that had Wilson been lucky enough to have some lawyer, maybe the lawyer who represented him in the criminal case, to at least take a look at this, notice the late filing, file a motion to dismiss. You would have argued for tolling and all of that, but you don't doubt that the court would have been perfectly appropriate to dismiss it with prejudice, do you?
At the time, if the court, if it had been raised, I believe the like the cases that there are other district court cases that are unpublished where the issue was timely raised and the district court did dismiss those cases.
Okay, so you stand here and you say, quite appropriately, he didn't have a lawyer. Whoever was helping him in the place of incarceration missed this issue. District court didn't abuse its discretion in denying a Rule 60B motion.
Well, at the time,
He didn't raise it. Final judgment entered, affirmed by this court, and that happened largely because he didn't have a lawyer. At least he didn't have a lawyer who was careful enough to take a close enough look at the file to see that there was a very powerful, I'm not going to call it a defense, but plea and bar, if you will, to the government successfully prosecuting this forfeiture action.
Well, that's true. Although, I mean, that's true. He did not have a lawyer at the time, and very likely a lawyer might have picked up on it. I have had experience where lawyers a lot of times don't know any more about asset forfeiture law than.
Well, but do they know about timelines?
They would.
Asset forfeiture law to look at a statute and see that Congress said if you don't file it in 90 days, you're not entitled to it. That's all the lawyer would have to do.
Right. That's correct. That's correct. But I think in this case.
By the way, have you ever had a lawyer file such a motion?
On
a late file?
No.
This is the first time.
What's your strongest argument that 983 is not jurisdictional? It kind of looks like Congress was trying to do that, make it jurisdictional. To me, what's your strongest argument that it's not jurisdictional?
Well, I think the statutory language itself, the statute itself doesn't indicate it is intended to be jurisdictional. The fact that it is located in Title 18 of the criminal provisions of the U.S. Code versus in Title 28 or the chapter that normally involves jurisdiction, I think that's an indication. And as Justice Niemeyer indicated, it is captioned General Rules for Civil Forfeiture Proceedings, and then in addition to all that, I believe that and after hearing argument earlier, maybe this is not
the authority for the forfeiture.
Pardon me?
I think the most telling point is that the judicial authority for a federal court to effect a forfeiture is contained in a different statute.
Yes.
A civil forfeiture that authorizes this is, I think, 28 U.S.C. Section 881. And that, to me, confers the subject matter jurisdiction on the court. And these are the rules of procedures for effecting it. But you wouldn't need 881 if this was jurisdictional here.
That's correct. The jurisdiction of the court is in Title 21 U.S.C. 881. And also over civil forfeiture proceedings in Title 28, 1355. In addition, I believe that when you read the statute, it appeared that the fact that the court could extend the deadline, that could actually occur after the deadline had passed. And I think that is possible from a reading of the statute when you look at subpart B in particular, when it says if the government does not file a complaint for forfeiture or return the property, then you go down, the government shall promptly release the property. And it does not also qualify that by saying that in addition to filing the complaint or returning the property, the court and extending the deadline. It doesn't include that in with that language. So I think from a reading of the statute, it could be interpreted that Congress intended that the ability of the court to extend the deadline past the deadline or to actually make that decision gives the court jurisdiction beyond the deadline.
And so now I've heard about 15 arguments, but I asked which was your strongest.
Pardon me?
I asked which was your strongest argument. You gave me, I think, just about all of them.
Okay.
Maybe Judge Niemeyer gave you your strongest one, but what do you think your single strong? Not that you can't have all those. I'm just asking what you think is your single strongest argument that this is not jurisdictional.
Well, I would agree with Judge Niemeyer that it
probably was a good choice.
Yes.
I'm not sure it's the best one.
I didn't say best. I said good.
Okay, and I think as well the courts have historically not treated this statutory provision as jurisdictional. Neither the U.S. Supreme Court nor the Courts of Appeals have addressed it, but the district courts that have been faced with challenges to the deadline after the time it expired have extended it by tolling it, or where the reasons for missing it were.
But clearly, Congress wanted the government to have to do something in a timely fashion. Wasn't this really to address the problem of Congress just sitting forever? Wasn't just to add some certainty and to make Congress wanted the government to have to act in a timely fashion if they wanted to have that property?
Yes, that's correct. That's correct.
Is that consistent then with the way you read the statute? If that is the purpose, is that consistent with the way you read the statute?
Well, I think it is. I think it's there are situations where the court, even in the Civil Asset Forfeiture Reform Act and other situations where the administrative deadline can be extended with judicial permission. And I think in this case, the deadline could be extended with judicial permission. I don't think the government can.
So you think it was pressure for the government to move forward, but it wasn't a drop dead date. That 90 days is just not drop dead.
No,
that's it's just to put pressure on the government. But you think the statute allowing that to be extended by agreement or good cause, that just meant Congress was saying hurry up and put them on notice and try to get it done. But 90 is not a drop dead day time.
Well, I think 90 is a. I'm not making light of the deadline. The deadline is a very serious deadline. And we appreciate the fact that we need to be filing the complaint accordingly to protect people, their rights. I think it's just an indication that the government does need to respond within a certain period of time, and in limited circumstances, the court could extend that if it's good cause or reasonable to do that.
Does that about cover it?
The only other point I'd like to make, Your Honor, is that even though the government did miss the deadline, we did, and we are aware of the purpose for the passage of the Asset Forfeiture Reform Act. We did act within the spirit of the purpose, and that is that we did try, even though it was filed late and it was not knowingly done so, Wilson was not prejudiced here. He had his day in court. The law enforcement abuses in seizing assets that were of concern with the Congress when they passed the Civil Asset Forfeiture Reform Act are not present here. He's not an innocent party whose assets were taken from him. Because of some action of some other third party.
Are you arguing equities to us now?
Well, I'm actually advocating
sort of like an actual innocence argument. You guys really got the right money, and therefore it's justified. But of course, and we entered a judgment forfeiting it. But mm-hmm. The only way we can remove that is if we didn't have jurisdiction, right. Power, and of course, whether the equities in it doesn't affect jurisdiction.
Well, I think where I'm going is because the Supreme Court in Henderson versus Shinseki had indicated that because of the risk of waste of judicial resources if the court should find that the court didn't have jurisdiction after the case has gone to trial and we put all this time and effort into it. The Supreme Court has indicated that the deadline should not be designated as jurisdictional unless it goes to the subject matter or personal jurisdiction of the court. And so I'm just trying to indicate here, this is a potential case where we would have that situation that the Supreme Court was worried about, that he did get his day in court, not only in the civil forfeiture, albeit he defended himself, He did get his day in court. He did present evidence to establish the legitimacy of the money. The district court evaluated that in great detail and granted summary judgment for the government. The only other thing would be this, you know, this is not a jurisdictional defect. What we have here is a time limitation that he waived by not raising it. And I would ask the court to affirm the district court.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Puller. Mr. Dietz.
Thank you, Your Honors. Very briefly, Judge Niemeyer, I want to address your point about Section 881. I think an important distinction, I'll acknowledge in the Arbaugh versus Y&H Corporation case, the Supreme Court, that was an important factor for them, that in Title VII there was a jurisdictional provision and that the definition of employer was in a separate section. But I think there's an important distinction here, and that is that Title VII was enacted by Congress all at one time. So Congress, when they created Title VII, created that jurisdictional provision, put the employer provision somewhere else. But here we have CAFRA, we have Section 983. And Section 881 was pre-existing at that time, as was 1355, the other jurisdictional provision. And it would have been very strange for Congress, because, of course, Congress doesn't have to do anything specific to create a jurisdictional provision. It just needs to intend to do so. And so it would have been strange for them to strip away one provision.
They have to have authority. They have to have authority. Federal courts are limited jurisdiction, and they have to have create the authority to do this. And if you think in terms of the power of the court being emanating from the Constitution and managed by Congress, this is a drop-dead date, but I'm not sure they intended to deprive the court of power. I think they intended to deprive the government of the right to proceed against the money, and which is slightly different.
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, that takes me to my second point, which is I see the court's frustration with the government for violating this congressional mandate, but I want to make clear that if this court's holding is that this is a waivable claims processing rule, the next time a U.S. attorney is before this court and this has happened, they will not be nearly so apologetic. And the reason is that there are a number of cases out there in different contexts where the federal courts and state bars have said it is not a Rule 11 violation to file, for example, a lawsuit after the statute of limitations has expired or any other waivable deadline, and it's not unethical. So the government in this case, if it's just a waivable deadline, can completely frustrate the congressional intent here and the plain language of this statute by simply ignoring the mandate and taking the chances.
Well, they won't frustrate congressional intent if we say there's not jurisdictional. Congressional intent is not that it's jurisdictional, will they?
Well, Your Honor, I think the congressional intent is that the government not be able to file a forfeiture action after the deadline.
It's still a drop-dead deadline. It's still going to end their case.
Well, I think, but again, it's
the question is whether when they file late, the defense is raised. But the authority to forfeit and the authority to hear this type of case, your argument is it's they've. Fundamental power of the court is affected, and these cases are always difficult. Because, and I think your reliance on the Bowles case is totally proper. It points out the problems of this whole area. When is it jurisdictional? When's it not? And just because it's mandatory and drop dead, they've said that's not enough. So what do we look at? And we try to figure out: did Congress intend to have this affect the power of the court? Or did it have its intent to regulate the government in its prosecution? Now, if it's the latter, then it seems to me it's a limitation because it regulates the government. It doesn't regulate the court.
That's correct, Your Honor.
The question is this section regulating the court, the power of the court? And it's not always that clear, is it?
That's correct, Your Honor. I think that at bottom, my argument is, of course, I think if the members of this panel sat in Congress as experts in jurisprudence, we wouldn't have this problem. You would know what to say. But Congress
has labeled it jurisdiction.
Exactly.
And jurisdiction
as you can
conferred only if exercised.
I understand that, Your Honor. In fact, but if you look at Bowles, if you look at John R. Sand and Gravel, if you look at Gonzales, even after this court has said to Congress, label it jurisdictional, Congress still doesn't label it jurisdictional. And I think at the end of the day, what this court has to do is decide what did Congress want. And here, to make it jurisdictional, Judge Davis, as you indicated, will allow the district courts on their own initiative to examine this. And knowing that pro se litigants are not going to know about this deadline and not raise it, the only way to affect this congressional intent to do what Congress wanted to do here is to have it be jurisdictional. And so if Congress understood the legal consequences, they would have wanted this to be jurisdictional.
But you keep leaving out what the Supreme Court has told us to do on these questions, what we have to look at. We just can't say what Congress meant to do, but we have to do it through the prism that the Supreme Court tells us to apply to it.
That's correct.
You might commit, this was the first impression, that idea of just listen to Congress and do what Congress says, you'd be writing more of a blank slate. But you keep leaving out that third part of that tripod, which is Congress, us, and the Supreme Court.
That's right.
The Supreme Court clearly has developed this area of the law anywhere beyond what they had, prior to the last 10 years or so. And Congress, almost certainly, God bless them, they don't have any idea, because courts struggle with it. Congress doesn't know the distinction.
Yes, Your Honor. I think the court understands my arguments.
Thank you, Mr. Dietz.
Whatever you want to do is fine.
I want to take a little recess. Up to you.